What can we learn from rats? Quite a bit, if you believe the conclusions of John B. Calhoun, a mid-20th century ecologist who studied the effects of overcrowding on rats and whose conclusions influenced urban planning for humans for decades. Calhoun's work is featured in the new book, Rat City, Overcrowding and Urban Derangement in the Rodent Universes of John B. Calhoun, by John Adams and Edmund Ramsden. Edmund is a historian of science at Queen Mary University of London, and John is an author and a former BBC New Generation thinker. Here's John to share five of their big ideas.
I'm John Adams, co-author with Edmund Ramsden of Rat City, Overpopulation and Urban Derangement in the Rodent Universes of John B. Calhoun. Calhoun was an ecologist turned psychologist who, from the 1940s to the early 1980s, spent four decades investigating the link between crowding and behavior in rats and humans. Initially hired to counter a rodent infestation in post-war Baltimore, he discovered that rats were gregarious animals who formed complex hierarchical societies. To more closely observe rodent society, Calhoun built an artificial city block, what he called a rodent utopia, where his animals would have their every need met, except space. As population density in the rat city increased, crowding caused the rats to become stressed, and they began to exhibit increasingly severe behavioral problems. The highly ordered family units broke down. Mothers neglected their young. Young males became violent and hypersexual. As rising crime and civic unrest swept 1960s America, the similarities between Calhoun's rat cities and social breakdown in the crowded metropolis were irresistible. From the peculiar career of Jack Calhoun, here's five rat bites. Number one, rats practice birth control, sort of. Rats breed so rapidly that it's theoretically possible to turn two rats into almost 2,000 in a little over 12 months. But this sort of fertility never actually occurs in the real world. Calhoun wondered, why not? Studying rats in Baltimore during the late 1940s, Calhoun discovered that population numbers were fixed at around 150 individuals per city block. While the residents were horrified by how many rats lived in the city, the ecologists were surprised there were so few. 150 rats per block probably sounds like more than enough for company, but it was a number much lower than the environmental resources permitted. In the downtown back alleys, there was no shortage of garbage to eat, and, apparently, plenty of places to nest. And yet the population cap was robust. When a block's rat population was reduced by poisoning or trapping, it soon bounced back, but it never exceeded the 150 rat limit. To Calhoun's amazement, it seemed as if the rats were able to exercise their own form of birth control. But how? Further investigation revealed rat society was held in a delicate balance, and raising pups past weaning required a surprising degree of domestic harmony. If a nursing mother was disturbed, she may attempt to relocate her young, or abandon her nest and pups altogether. Under normal circumstances, a dominant male would stand guard to prevent nest invasions, but even the toughest kingpins would eventually be overwhelmed if the population grew too large. And so, when social density increased, things began to fall apart as squabbling destabilized the family units, and ultimately caused the reproductive rates in the overpopulated area to decline until they settled back at the optimal level. The mysterious mechanism behind the spontaneous regulation of population size was discovered to be a limit imposed not by available food, but by available space. And crucially, a habitat was socially full long before that space ran out. Number two. Crowding isn't a proximity problem, it's a communication problem. When we think about crowding, we're often thinking about the number of other individuals in the same space as us. But it's not just proximity that makes crowding unpleasant. Crowding is stressful not only because we're physically close to one another, but because we might have to interact with those other individuals. In other words, not so much physical contact we dread a social contact. Luckily, we're really good at ignoring each other. The city dweller becomes adept at the thousand-yard stare. On the daily commute, we studiously avoid making eye contact and certainly don't make conversation. When everyone agrees to play along with this asocial contract, it creates a collective illusion of invisibility, like a toddler playing hide-and-seek who thinks that because they can't see you, you can't see them. And it works. Rats, sadly, lack the ability to ignore one another. In the wild, when population density increased, rats would simply emigrate to a new habitat. But trapped inside his rat cities, Calhoun's rodents soon found the frequency of social contact troublesome. Constantly obliged to greet other rats, measure their dominance ranking, and undertake an endless process of threat assessment, they became so harried by their social milieu that they lost their good manners, grew hostile. In time, that led to more severe behavioral problems, escalating violence, and ultimately population collapse. Calhoun's work with rats and mice made him realize how remarkable was the human capacity to close off our social obligations. Indeed, it's this flair for voluntary social withdrawal that made the growth of cities possible. So while we often cite the human genius for communication as the secret to our success, just as important was learning how to ignore one another. Number 3. A good fence is a fence you can step over. Robert Frost's 1913 poem, Mending Wall, sees two neighbours at work repairing the dry stone boundary wall between their properties. As the poet questions why they need a wall at all, his neighbour stubbornly encants the old aphorism that good fences make good neighbours. It's perhaps easy to imagine a good neighbour, but what's a good fence? In his early experiments, Calhoun divided his rat cities into separate cells, using high walls topped with electric wires to strictly control which areas of the enclosure rats could move between. The rats became conditioned to cluster in a single cell, resulting in severe overcrowding, social breakdown, and brutal violence. In later experiments, these barriers were replaced with low dividers that the rats could step over, but which, crucially, were sufficient to insulate them from unwanted contact. A tall fence topped with electric wire is not a neighbourly fence. Good fences are fences that demarcate borders while allowing those on either side to communicate. They are socially permeable. On at least the street side of the property, a picket fence at waist or even knee height does the job, signals a border, and assumes that the passerby is decent enough not to step over it. Any taller, and the fence tacitly presumes the intent to trespass. In Mending Wall, Frost was skeptical of the need for a physical boundary at all, and yet he was seemingly engaged in conversation with his neighbour the whole time they were repairing their low stone wall. Maybe good neighbours make good fences. Number 4. More privacy isn't always better. Working in a remote Canadian mental institution in the 1950s, psychologists Robert Sommer and Humphrey Osmond found that the cavernous, open-plan wards were further unsettling their already disturbed inhabitants. An open space was more stressful for their patients than a closed cell. They discovered that simply by erecting folding screens and rearranging chairs, they could make the wards more peaceful. It was from this work that Sommer later developed the concept of personal space we still use today. But while some degree of privacy was beneficial, it was possible to have too much. In the 1970s, architect Oscar Newman borrowed from ecology the idea of territoriality and applied it to public housing. His theory of defensible space was intended to give residents in public housing a sense of ownership. But the focus on private territory and personal safety instead fostered suspicion and hostility. It was a logic that led to gated communities and billionaires building bunkers to wait out the apocalypse. Living in Boston's West End in the early 1950s, sociologist Herb Gans learned, have a stoop, a porch, a place you can sit which bridges private and public. Building communal spaces builds community. The same was true for rodents. Calhoun designed his later enclosures so there would be a central section in which the rats from different colonies might gather to socialize without trespassing on one another's home turf. Being able to control the volume and frequency of social contact made life far less stressful for his rodents, and they lived longer and were able to endure much higher population densities. Privacy is desirable, but its value does not increase with its quantity. Those billionaires who imagine they might survive the end of the world in a bunker forget that a bunker you can't leave is just a tomb in which you aren't yet dead. Number 5. A rat is a symptom of bad housing, not a cause. New York City's Mayor Eric Adams recently appointed a rat czar to bring down the city's rodent population, declaring, "I hate rats, and I'm confident most of our city's residents do as well." We vilify the rat as a totem of urban decay, but rats thrive only where care has been withdrawn. In the 1940s, the city of Baltimore made a concerted effort to improve housing stock, and as they did so, found the urban rodent population was also drastically reduced. It turned out that the most enduring method of rat control was good property maintenance. Regular refuse collection, fixing broken pipes and fittings, and draft-proofing buildings prevented rats from inhabiting the same spaces as residents. Bad buildings incubated rat colonies, and bad buildings in their turn led to social problems. As an activist chant from the 1960s put it, "Rats cause riots." But the tail doesn't really wag the dog, and you couldn't solve the rioting simply by removing the rats. Throughout his career, Calhoun remained adamant that eradicating rats was a purely cosmetic operation, and any program of rodent eradication would only ever achieve short-term success so long as the underlying structural problems were neglected. As one colleague put it, rats are a symptom of bad housing, not a cause. The rat was a sentinel species, their presence a signal that the infested neighborhood needed maintenance and repair. And hence, if your focus is on killing the rats, you're really just shooting the messenger.
Thank you, John. That was 5 big ideas from Rat City: Overcrowding and Urban Derangement in the Rodent Universes of John B. Calhoun by John Adams and Edmund Ramsden. I'm Michael Kovnet. Have a great day.